Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the April 2023 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Moralia. Over the last 3 years, and really since 2016, we've been reporting on Outbeat News about an escalation of anti-LGBTQ legislation, especially bills targeting transgender rights. In fact, just this year, agencies like the ACLU are tracking over 400 pieces of legislation across the United States that seek to take away various rights and freedoms from LGBTQ people. Tonight, our guest is an attorney from Oakland. He's a transgender man who's currently serving as the president of Oakland Pride. Attorney Michael Huff will share his personal story and talk about the changes we are all witnessing today. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio News for this Sunday, April 23rd, 2023. I'd love to change the world. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of April 23rd, 2023. 40 professional athletes have signed a letter opposing a piece of federal legislation seeking to ban trans women and girls from participating in women's sports. House Resolution 734 was introduced by Representative Greg Stube, a Republican from Florida, as the Protection of Women and Girls in Sports Act of 2023. It would amend Title IX regulation so that an individual's biological sex at birth who was male, cannot participate in programs for women and girls. The letter was spearheaded by advocacy organization Athlete Ally, and the letter's signatures include LGBTQ plus greats like Megan Rapinoe, Sue Bird, Chris Moyer, and CeCe Telfer. It declares, quote, that every child deserves to have their life changed for the better by being able to participate in the sport that they love, end quote. It also acknowledged the life-saving power of sports, explaining how athletes found friends, confidence, life lessons, and a sense of self through their teams. The athletes also pointed out that the bill could have negative repercussions on both trans and cisgender women. It said, quote, if this bill passes, transgender and intersex girls and women throughout the country will be forced to sit on the sidelines, away from their peers and their communities. Furthermore, the policing of who can and cannot play sports will very likely lead to the policing of the bodies of girls, including cisgender girls. This will deter girls from participating in sports and create additional barriers, end quote. The letter concluded by encouraging lawmakers to focus on policies that would actually advance equality, such as equal pay and an end to abuse and mistreatment, uneven implementation of Title IX, and a lack of access for equity for girls of color and girls with disabilities. They also warned that the bill will make trans and intersex kids feel isolated, excluded, and othered. And in Missouri, the Republican Attorney General Andrew Bailey put out an emergency regulation last week severely restricting gender-affirming care, claiming that gender-affirming care is already banned in the state due to a state law blocking some medical treatments deemed to be dangerous. A vast majority of major medical associations in the United States supports providing gender-affirming care to trans people, youth, and adults. And many health experts say bills targeting gender-affirming care are based on unscientific reports. In the regulation, any medical intervention for trans people would require psychological or psychiatric assessment and would institute a 3-year waiting period. Those assessments would need to be 15 sessions across 18 months. Individuals who transition would have to get medical follow-up in the 15 years following the intervention. The regulation goes into effect on April 27th. Bailey, who's up for re-election in 2024, wrote on Twitter that he was putting the regulation in place, quote, because gender transition interventions are experimental and have significant side effects. State law already prohibits performing these procedures in the absence of substantial guardrails that ensure informed consent and adequate access to medical care, end quote. Lambda Legal and the American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri have said they will file legal action against the rule. They said, quote, the Attorney General's so-called emergency rule is based on distorted, misleading, and debunked claims and ignores the overwhelming body of scientific and medical evidence supporting this care, as well as the medical experts and doctors who work with transgender people every day. And here in the Bay Area, gay Santa Clara City Council member Anthony Becker is facing one felony charge stemming from his role in leaking a report about the dealings between the South Bay's city leaders and the San Francisco 49ers football team. The Santa Clara County Civil Grand Jury revealed last week that it had indicted Becker after he lied to it about his disclosing last October the grand jury's report titled unsportsmanlike conduct, Santa Clara City Council, end quote. The grand jury determined that several city council members, including Becker, had engaged in unethical relationships with the San Francisco 49ers. According to the five-page indictment released on April 14th, Becker provided a copy of the confidential document several days before it was to be released to the public on October 10th. It also said the grand jury had found evidence showing Becker had also leaked the report to a local news website, which reported on it 3 days before the report was published. In addition to being charged with perjury, Becker, who's 37 years old, also faces a misdemeanor charge for violating his duty to keep the draft report confidential. If convicted of perjury, Becker faces a maximum sentence of 4 years in county jail. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moraglia. My guest tonight is attorney Michael Huff. He works as a defense lawyer in Oakland, and he's also the president of Oakland Pride. Now, the very confident man you're about to hear tonight had a very different life before coming out. And he, like many others, are deeply troubled by the fierce and oppressive anti-LGBTQ legislation that's moving through state legislatures across the country. Bills targeting everything from drag shows to restroom access. Mr. Huff, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And all my friends call me Huff, so I'll insist that you do the same.
All right, Huff it is. Fantastic. You know, you have a fascinating background, and I can't wait to get into all the things that you're doing now, but I really would kind of like to start back where you grew up. Our listeners always love to hear the background and sort of the coming of age and coming out stories of our guests. So take us back.
Sure. Boy, I tell you what, I don't know how many coming out stories I have, at least two. But let's see, my very first coming out, I was a confused assigned female at birth, female at the time. And I believe I was around 16, if I remember correctly. And I decided to leave a book on my bed that said, "So you think you're a lesbian?" and go to school that day, which I did. And when I came home, my mom was on her knees crying and praying in the hallway. And that's how we handled that that coming out. But I did announce it at my high school, where I was at Jersey Village High School. I was vice president of my class and my freshman class. And I have to say that Texas, it gets a bad rap. I think that from a high level, it sounds like scary down south and you never know what could happen. And sometimes that's true. But from a more personal level, the majority of my friends and people who I knew were very accepting. I don't really remember, to be honest with you, how the administration was or how my teachers were. I know that my debate coach, Cindy Stoker, was very supportive of me. And it was a trying time in terms of learning how to navigate Houston, Texas. Back when I was coming out, I guess maybe I'll disagree with myself just a couple sentences later, but there were hardships in terms of external, provocations, if you will. So Kima Boardwalk is kind of like Santa Cruz Boardwalk, but in Texas, right? So, or any of the other, Mission Beach down in San Diego, that kind of thing, Venice and LA. Mm-hmm. And so you go to Kima Boardwalk, and I remember, I had decided to hold my girlfriend's hand at the time. Now that was a big deal, back in my day.
Now, what year is this? Just give us some context.
I'm trying to think. So high school for me, I'm actually a high school dropout. I dropped out my senior year in 1993. Okay. So we're looking about 1990, I want to say.
Got it.
89, 90. And I decided to hold my girlfriend's hand out at Kima Boardwalk, and we were immediately met with jeers and sneers. And I remember being called the dyke, and someone threw trash at the back of my head. Someone threw a bottle down at my feet. And I guess we'll probably get into it, but later when I became a police officer and I was closeted in Houston, Texas, I was afraid to come out. There were a number of different discriminatory acts made against me. I had a vagina drawn next to my name when I was promoted to corporal. I had a doll hanging out of my patrol mailbox with a noose around its neck. So it can be rough. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's all relative, because when I say that Texas gets a bad rap, even now when I go back to Texas, I absolutely know the difference between enjoying the freedoms of California, where I go in and out of a bathroom, whether I'm at the courthouse, police department, library, wherever I might be, concert, football game, I never think twice. When I was in Arizona recently, when I was in Texas recently, it's hard for it to not occur to me that just the simple act of me using the bathroom is considered good trouble in some places, right? That shouldn't be the case, but I digress. So that's my first coming out story back at 16, and you'll have to ask me the next question for more.
Well, so a number of things. Interesting way of telling your parents with a book. You know, everybody has their way of doing that. So you were a lesbian, you identified as a lesbian for several years, but when did you come to the realization that this is more, this is about gender identity too?
You know, I'll keep it personalized to myself. Maybe I just wasn't aware, or maybe it was a part of my generation, right? I think innately and deep down, I always knew that something wasn't right about me being in a female body, right? Mm-hmm. But growing up in Texas, and certainly before I even understood that maybe that means you're a lesbian, right? These thoughts or feelings or love that you have for people of the same sex, for women. But I, even as I got older, I just thought I was a weird lesbian. Like, I would joke around and say, I'm a man trapped in a woman's body. Well, back in my day, it wasn't a readily available conversation that, hey, that means transgender,
right?
And then I got busy with, you know, college, careers, building a law firm, working on my law firm, et cetera. And I looked up one day and I was 40 years old and I was still a weird lesbian. And all of a sudden, my friends who are psychiatrists and psychologists and LMFTs, therapists, and so forth, are picking up on the jokes that I tell aren't exactly only humor, right? It's a way to sort of appease myself and try to deal with my cognitive dissonance, because I never felt right in a woman's bathroom. I never felt right in the girls' locker room. I refused to dress out when I was in junior high because I didn't feel like I should be changing in the girls' locker room. Now, it never connected for me though that I could transition and be my authentic self. That wasn't on the table back then, right? Like, the best that you could do would be a cool tomboy, and then later a soft butch as a lesbian, and then maybe a little bit more butch where I was from. But transitioning never occurred to me. So at 40 years old, I had a friend of mine who's a psychologist, and she's in her 70s, and she said, and I went by Renee at the time. And incidentally, I was born Michelle Renee Huff, and I'm still Michelle Renee Huff. It was M-I-C-H-E-L-L-E. I just dropped off the L-E, and I took R-E-N-E-E and dropped the E off. So it's the masculine French name to what was the feminine French name. I don't consider that I have a dead me or a dead name or a dead self. I just moved into the right body, but this is still the same Michelle Renee Huff that you had from year 1 through 40. He just figured out how to present himself in a way that actually feels good when he gets up in the morning, mm-hmm. and that feels good when he walks outside. And when he talks to a judge in a courtroom, he feels like he's where he's supposed to be now. Sans triple D breasts that never felt like they were supposed to be there, right? That's a pretty big deal, pun intended.
Yeah.
I kind of moved all over the place there on you, but, you know, so at 40, when Joyce, Dr. Swinehart Moore said, Renee, are you sure that you're not transgender? It was the first time that anyone had asked me that. And I feel like I knew immediately when she asked me. It was kind of that aha moment, right? And it's interesting to live all the way to 40 and then have someone who's not lived your life be able to tell you more about yourself than you know for yourself.
Right.
But that was the awakening moment. And then I started doing more research and looking into it to find out, is this right for me? I was on my second career as a lawyer. So police officer first. I've had, it seems like, every job under the sun as well before that. Janitor, sold bottled water, worked for UPS. I could go on and on. But I'd never really took time, because I was so busy surviving, that I hadn't moved up Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right?
Right.
To anything beyond survival, shelter, you know, maybe some nice clothes and so forth. But I was nowhere near self-actualization. And so at 40, you really start looking. And I did.
Good for you. And it makes sense given the time that you grew up, right? Because there weren't any, first, we didn't have a lot of language to talk about what being transgender is. We didn't really have a good concept of gender identity, and it was still very much regarded scientifically, medically, socially as a disorder, and nobody wants that, right? But there weren't role models either, and
right.
So I totally get why you wouldn't have made that connection. But of course, now is a very different time, and thank goodness you did. How did it go with your family when you came out now as transgender?
That was the, I think, one of the best unexpected. I expected to be accepted. I wasn't sure how they would respond. My mother said that she always felt, and you always hear these things after, it's kind of like the relationship that you're in and your friends won't tell you that you need to break up with so-and-so, but as soon as you do, then they give you the whole list of what was wrong with so-and-so.
Right.
And you think, why didn't you tell me this before, right? Well, you know, I came out as trans and everybody basically apparently knew before I did again. And so my mom confided in me or revealed to me that she always felt like she was carrying a boy when she was pregnant with me. But
interesting.
Just never found a reason to ever tell me that information. And I wonder, I mean, I refused to wear dresses. I only chose boy toys. I never played with dolls, all of the things that would make anyone that thought that they were carrying a boy look and scratch their head and say, maybe this kid also thinks he's a boy. But again, you know, if I, living as a trans person, didn't know, I can hardly charge it against my mother that she didn't.
Right, right. How interesting that she said that. You know,
yep. And then another little piece that, and I want to keep giving Texas its props where I can, you know, they're the creators of the good old boy system, right? In Texas, when you think Texas, people, when I say I was a police officer in Texas, people go, oh, right. For a reason. And I have to say, and they're self-admitted rednecks too. But some of the most deepest rednecks, right-wing Republicans who I would have really thought maybe they weren't going to talk to me anymore, have embraced me. And, you know, the chief of police at Harris County Precinct 4, all three of them, or two of them, and the constable himself, Unit 1, and the former chief, they really rallied behind me. Not that there was anything to rally about, but in terms of making sure that I understood that whether I was Renee with three E's or two, I was still their Renee Huff. And I was the first female, first African-American female supervisor in the history of the department. And I was the youngest in the history of the department. I have an argument with a deputy, well, former deputy, on who was the youngest. I think he wins, but I did it the fastest too. I think I did it in under 2 years. So there are a lot of things that she did that, and I honor my divine feminine and my divine masculine. So we're both in here if you have to give gender roles, and, you know, just be glad I don't charge double.
Exactly. So why law enforcement? I mean, what drew you to it?
Easy, hands down. I was born bossy and nosy by nature, and then I became authorized. I have always jumped into things that are none of my damn business, quite frankly, because I want to help people. If I see the underdog, if I see an elderly person being mistreated, if I see a child being abused out in the world, I'm either going to jail or I have to have the authority to take somebody to jail because I'm going to do something about it. And that's just innate in who I am and in my nature. And then secondarily, I couldn't afford college or law school. And so I had to figure out, I was paying for two classes a semester and going as often as I could, as much as I could. And I naively thought law enforcement, lawyer. I knew I wanted to be a lawyer since I was 7 years old. So 41 years ago, I knew that I would be Attorney Huff today. And I am. And I needed a way to pay for school. And I wanted something that was close to the law or involved in the law. And I don't know why I didn't go and apply at a law firm of all things and be a clerk or anything else besides a police officer. But that nosy and bossy by nature got the better of me. And I thought, you know, let me go use my, I'm uniquely positioned to use this skill set. And I have a heart for service. I've always, even now that I've almost accomplished most of the things on my to-do list, as far as, you know, there's some other things that are extra or maybe some niceties, but today, whether I have someone write me a really big check or wire me significant funds, or someone calls me and says, Attorney Huff, you changed my life, or thank you, you got a second chance for my son, and now he's in college, and he's doing great, and he's got this or that, that always beats the money. Don't get me wrong, I'm not allergic to money, and I love money. Feel free to send all that you like, but it's not the feel-good feeling that makes me get up in the morning. It's that making a difference. And I saw law enforcement as an opportunity to do that.
Yeah. You know, I think life always takes you where you're supposed to go, at least in a lot of cases. And I'm sure that your law enforcement experience has made you a much better attorney than if you didn't have that experience. But I want to go back to your agency, and you know, you mentioned a couple of examples of some really horrible things that happened to you there. But what was the culture at that time in a law enforcement agency in Texas around LGBTQ people in general?
Well, let me kick it off this way. On my first FTO ride, my field training officer, my FTO, pointed out a woman deputy at the gas station where we were both gassing up and said, watch out for that one. She's batting for the other team. Of course, on the inside, I thought, well, let me make sure I find out who that is and talk to her immediately. Right. But I was in the closet and I was scared and I was afraid to lose my job. And I was definitely afraid to be the female deputy standing out, gassing up my car and having the FTO point at me to the next new deputy. Right. And say, stay away from her. Right. So I said, thank you. And I said, good to know. And I nodded my head and I made sure that I started wearing lipstick and getting my nails done very soon after that so that I wouldn't be detected as someone batting for the other team.
So what was it like going through the academy for you? I remember for me, it was terrifying because of exactly that reason. I didn't want to be found out. Because the culture, even here in California around law enforcement, was completely unaccepting of gay people.
Right. And I think cis men have a harder time in that respect to a certain degree. I can only speak, obviously, from my own personal experience. There may have been a few stray remarks about, you know, Huff can fight with the men and hold her own and that kind of thing, but never really anything that was derogatory because I think I did such a good job at staying below the radar. Now, you know, I would later be told by most of the people that they had an idea, but whatever I was doing, it was enough to placate the masses and sort of not raise too many eyebrows or draw too much attention. But again, in the female settings, it's not as... they don't pour women into the same groups in the way that they do for men. So, you know, you don't have open showering, or most times, you know, women aren't walking around fully nude in a locker room, things that can be really off-putting, I would imagine, if I were in the other locker room as a cis gay man, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit more of a sisterhood that you can hide behind, if you will, or at the time. Now, I can't speak for now, but at the time, it just wasn't an issue because I didn't allow it to be. But on the inside, it was very painful because every day I had to get ready, and I made a deal with myself. If this lipstick come, you know, whatever amount of this lipstick comes off during the day, you don't have to put it back on, right? But you have to leave the house with this eyeliner and lipstick on. Mm. You have to, right? I don't know a better articulation. That sucked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. There's not a fancy word for that. It hurt. Walking outside, feeling like you have to take a deep breath and then hold your breath for the rest of the day.
Yep.
Until you get home and then you can be you again.
Yep.
That's what that felt like. And that's what the climate was. And it was stifling. It stunted my emotional IQ growth. It did not allow me to acclimate and assimilate in environments. You know, there's a whole nother type of privilege besides white privilege, right? And I have to start talking about hetero privilege at some point, because I definitely did not, I wasn't a beneficiary of that.
Hmm. So I just want to make sure I've got the timeline right here. Did you transition then while you were on the police department, or were you already an attorney?
I left policing in 2004 to go to law school at South Texas College of Law. And I got a full scholarship from the Fraternal Order of Police. So I went to college full time and worked full time as a police officer. That's a whole nother episode, I think. And then I got into South Texas College of Law. And I began law school in 2004, and then I graduated law school in 2007, worked at Wilson Sonsini Goodrich and Rosati, still openly lesbian at that time, from 2008 to 2009. I missed the United States Judicial Law Clerkship that I had right after law school from 2007 to 2008. Still no idea that I'm trans at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Just a lesbian of color living my best life as far as I knew. And so 8 years ago, whatever that is, that's when it occurred to me that I needed to start taking steps, regardless of what anyone might think or have to say. And I was willing. And this is the big leap, I think. I have to love me the most. I'm unit one. And I secure my own air mask first, or else I can't help anyone else.
Absolutely.
If I'm securing other air masks and I run out of oxygen, well, there went the helper.
Right, right.
Right. So mine first. And once I realized that it was mine first, I was willing to lose anyone and anything. And you leap and the net will appear. It sounds terrifying, and it is terrifying, but the net does appear. And it was very scary because I was a successful female attorney, and I didn't think about a lot of things. I thought Black females had the worst end of the stick. No. Black men have the worst end of the stick. I didn't know. And I had to get over here and find out, because that's what I do.
Yeah.
Is show up and find out. But Black men have the worst end of the stick, having had the ability to live both as a woman of color and a man of color. It's something else, and it was quite the adjustment.
I was going to ask you about that later on, but since we're talking about it now, I met an LAPD officer, a trans man who transitioned. Mm-hmm. And that's what he talked about as being the most difficult part. It wasn't the tough part was not becoming a trans man or identifying as a trans man. The tough part was now identifying as a Black man.
Mm-hmm.
And the overt racism he experienced. He talked about walking through a store. Now, I see you nodding, and so I'm guessing maybe you've had the same experiences, but he was telling the story and my mouth just fell open, like, oh my God, that must have been absolutely horrible. Every time.
It's unbelievable. And remember, my mother, who's Irish German, my white mother raised me. So when I'm met with racism, it makes my eyes open this way. I didn't know for quite some time. Yeah, I come from a background where I used to tell Black people, pull yourself up by the bootstraps and stop playing the race card. Because when you're this complexion, you do not have the same experience as a darker complected African-American person. Mm-hmm. When I began dating African-American women and going frequenting the same stores, malls, everything, bookstores, as I did with my Tibetan girlfriend or my Caucasian girlfriend, only with my Black girlfriend did we need to put our bags behind the counter before we were allowed to walk through the store. Mm-hmm. Same store. Excuse me. A number of other incidents like that. And then as an attorney, when I transitioned, I had a white woman speak to me in a way that I still don't think, other than when I was a police officer on the street, I've ever had anyone speak to me. And she did that in an open law firm, completely demeaning me, berating me. And it was very clear that her opinion was a Black man didn't need to be talking at that time. And by the way, she wasn't an attorney even. She was staff.
Hmm. Wow. Well, let's go back to your career, because there's a lot to talk about that's really fascinating. You clerked for a federal judge, and you mentioned that a little bit ago, but I want to know a little bit more about that. What was that like? I mean, I think that the federal judiciary in general has kind of a stereotype that it's a very sort of old white guy, conservative environment. So what was that like for you to be clerking for that judge?
Sure. Let me back us up a little bit, because before I clerked, I interned and externed in the Southern District of Texas for a magistrate judge. And at the time in Texas, if you were a woman, you were in the federal courtroom and you worked for the federal court, you were required to wear dresses, skirts, mm-hmm. and usually the ivory pantyhose was the proper look. You smiling, it's not a fond memory for me, because I love the law so much. I made a deal with myself. Please, Renee, put on these pantyhose and go into this federal courthouse. And every day that I went to work as an intern in the Southern District of Texas, Fifth Circuit, I wore some sort of skirt suit with pantyhose. And that might not sound like it's the biggest deal in the world, but for me, it felt like dressing in drag that I didn't want to be in, right? I didn't wear dresses even as a child all the way to my adulthood. But now I was being told that if I wanted this job, the only way to have it and keep it was to show up in ivory hose. So fast forward to the District of Minnesota, quite a bit more liberal in Minnesota. That wasn't the requirement. My judge absolutely knew that I was openly lesbian, woman of color. It really was an exceptional experience. I would do it over and over again if given the opportunity. And I highly recommend it to anyone who has the opportunity to acquire either an internship, externship, or a federal clerkship. You absolutely should.
Did you experience any kind of overt homophobia or transphobia? Did you witness any of that in the?
So again, this was 2007, 2008. So I hadn't transitioned yet. And I have to say that the Minnesotans were quite inclusive in my experience in Minnesota. I don't know that I ever had any negative experience with respect to my sexual orientation or gender identity.
So when you went to law school, did you have aspirations of being a defense attorney? I mean, I think a lot of officers I know who have become attorneys are drawn to that work. And, you know, end up being great defense attorneys because they know the other side.
I'm smiling because I was completely against becoming a criminal defense attorney, and it was actually a marketing company that that provides leads to my firm. And he said, "You know, Attorney Huff, I'm sorry. I understand you said absolutely not to criminal defense, but I'm looking at your pedigree, and you are uniquely positioned to take on some of these leads. How about we just start you with a few of them, see how you like it, and." One thing led to another, and I have a thriving, growing firm that's growing faster than sometimes I can keep up with. We're scaling up, and I do enjoy the work, and I am uniquely positioned to do it. I think that, you know, I started with Wilson Sonsini, Goodrich & Rosati. I was in employment litigation and securities litigation, and I think I felt at the time to be a high-powered, well-respected attorney, I needed to be in big law, or I needed to have, you know, I needed to use the $6 words instead of one for a nickel. And now I've learned that you can communicate far better using the 5-cent word and reach far more people. And I really feel like I make a difference in people's lives, whether it's my clients directly or indirectly, their families. I will say that I enjoy a client base that is either minimal to no criminal history. People know, and I certainly advise them on our consultations, that if you want me to get to the truth, I absolutely am going to. Now, if you don't want your attorney to get to the truth, I'm not the right guy for you. And we start from there.
So what does that mean? That means that I'm guessing what I hear you say is that if you're guilty, I need to know that you're guilty, and I'll still do a great job representing you.
Absolutely. I will get you the best result that is warranted under the circumstances. I will not do magic tricks to turn the truth into a lie in a courtroom.
Right. And I think defense attorneys get a bad rap from law enforcement because they're seen as the ultimate goal is get the person off the hook.
Right.
And really, it's when I tell my administration of justice students, the defense attorney is what keeps the courtroom rolling. Because if people had to represent themselves, we would get nowhere. And you're not in an emotional place to be able to represent yourself. You're not in a knowledge place to represent yourself. You're not trained in the law. And so no matter how guilty someone is, everybody needs to have a good defense lawyer to make sure that their rights are adhered to and to make sure that they're entitled to all the due process rights that our system guarantees.
Absolutely, Greg. Absolutely. So, I agree.
So you talked about helping people. But what else about being a defense attorney now? What if you were to say this is the absolute most favorite part of the job for me?
I enjoy the investigation. I was nicknamed Pitbull when I was a police officer because if I got on a lead, I don't sleep, I don't rest, there is no break until I have you. That's just how my brain is wired. I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's just the truth. And so I enjoy that in my work. I prefer when people tell me the truth, but I don't mind using my skill set to unravel them and then present the truth to them and have them agree and mm-hmm. confirm that that's the truth. It's more painstaking and it's not my favorite, I should say, but I do like, stretching my legs intellectually. And this job allows me to do that. I usually, you know, we'll say the facts, the faces and the facts may change, but the gist of it is the same. But in criminal defense, just when I think I've seen it all, here comes the next thing to just absolutely blow my mind. And variety. I enjoy the variety.
Yeah. Oh, I'd imagine there's a lot of that. Let's switch to your family life. In your bio, you talk about how you appreciate spending time with your family. So tell us about your family.
Yeah, sure. I just married my beautiful wife in October. She was actually my best friend for 7 years, and we did not meet in person for 7 years.
Oh, wow.
We hung out on FaceTime. We were in I think it was mostly FaceTime, but we would just kind of hang out. She would do her work and I would do my work, and we became fast friends, and this lasted for 7 years. And I'll omit some varying details, but a few things happened and I decided to tell her I wasn't in the friend zone anymore, and she welcomed that notification. So now she's Mrs. Huff and I'm trying to do my best job to be a great husband.
That's awesome. That is really
We've got a French bulldog, and I have a 13-foot boa constrictor right behind me in her house. Her name's Whom. Not many people have a 13-foot snake in their house, but I do.
Yeah, I did read that as well.
I see the look on your face. I won't bring her to your house. Don't worry.
Good.
And I never let the French bulldog visit her either. So that's how that works.
That's probably a good thing. And I'm definitely not a snake person. So I appreciate the fact that you're going to keep the snake at home. Your practice is in Oakland, which is a rough city for sure. But it has my sense is that it has a very large growing LGBT community that's becoming more visible and more vibrant and more influential. Is that a proper characterization?
I'll push back a little bit. One, on a rough city, I think that it's concentrated in its population. And therefore, if you run the numbers and look at the demographics, sure, it's up there in terms of activity, criminal activity, and so forth. But I don't know that it's any rougher than any of the other cities. We've all got crime. We all have political issues and unrest. Just Oakland is very vocal and will come out and you're going to hear about it. That's what I love about Oakland. And then also with respect to, I would say that yes, the LGBTQI plus community is expanding and evolving, but I have to say Oakland roots run pretty deep. And, you know, what, 2009, since my time in Oakland, I've always sensed and felt a very strong LGBT community. Now, you're talking to a trans man who was a lesbian of color who ran out and joined the executive board of Oakland Pride as one of my very first things after opening my law firm. And now I'm the president of Oakland Pride, right? So I don't know how unbiased my perspective is or how objective it can really be, because I've always been active in the LGBT community. And so that's the activity that I see going on. It's been strong and I feel like it keeps on getting better in Oakland.
Yeah, I guess where I'm getting that from is I've covered some stories over the years about the opening of the center and then watched the Pride celebrations get larger and larger and larger and larger, more visible, more visible, more visible. And so it just strikes me that the community must be becoming more visible. I think
in that respect,
go ahead.
Yeah. In that respect, I apologize for interrupting. In that respect, I agree with you. Joe Hawkins is doing the executive director of the LGBT Center. He's doing an amazing job. We have Oakland Pride that's been around since our charter members started that in 2010. And then there's also Pride Fest, which is another Pride organization that'll be having their event in September. So you do see, and the sponsorship has been really great for both of the organizations. So I do agree with you there that there's more visibility now than there's ever been. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So with as busy as you are with a growing legal practice, a new wife, and you've taken on this role of president of Pride, what motivates you to keep going with that civic volunteerism, I'll call it?
You know, when people ask me this, you know, I got made fun of when I was younger, because in my interviews, they would say, you know, why do you want this job? It was always in customer service. Every single thing I've ever done has been some form of customer service. And I would say, because I want to help people. Now that I'll be 48 this month, I can say it with certainty and security behind me. Because I want to help people, Professor. That's why. And that's actually my answer. And I get to keep that answer and have that be legitimate and valid. I love helping people. There's nothing else that makes me feel better. It's my drug. It's my alcohol. I'll have 5 years sobriety this July. And I get high off of helping people.
Well, that's a pretty good drug to take if you're going to take one, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the best one so far.
Well, wow. All of the anti-LGBT legislation that's out there. Before we went on air, we were talking about Tennessee, which I think is probably one of the grossest bills that has been signed into law. For our listeners who are not familiar with what happened in Tennessee in March and the law and the scope of that law, because I don't think that's been entirely visible in the media, tell us about it and the impact it's going to have, particularly on transgender people.
Sure. I will have to just take it from a high level. I haven't read the legislation myself, but a candidate who I'm supporting and rapidly becoming dear friends with, I would like to think, Olivia Hill, is running for city council member at large in Tennessee. And she advised me that in addition to it being a felony to perform publicly in drag, also individuals who are under 18 who have transitioned will be required to detransition. So if I were under 18, if I were not of age, I would have to theoretically or presumably shave my beard, stop taking hormone replacement therapy, possibly replace testosterone with estrogen. And I'm not sure what they would want me to do with the fact that I've had top surgery, right? I had triple D breasts at the time. So are you required to have breast augmentation then? These are slippery slopes that the government has no business whatsoever with these types of intimacies with the citizen, with people, with humanity, with human beings' bodies. I don't know a better way, another way to put it. And there are a number of other consequences that are tied into the legislation that are equally abhorrent.
So where do you think all this animus is coming from? I mean, it just seems to be getting worse and worse and worse instead of getting better. And a lot of it is being very specifically targeted at transgender people, whether it be restrooms, whether it be preventing parents from allowing their kids to use hormone blockers, to, as you say, outlawing drag performances, which may or may not have anything to do with the trans community. But where's this animus coming from?
I haven't been able to figure it out. But something seems to happen to the grown-ups when they hit a certain age. I don't know whether it's children. I don't know whether it's a certain age bracket or window. You hit, you know, 55 to 60, and that changes your outlook on life. And I'm sort of tongue-in-cheek with this, but I'm being sincere. My mother voted for Trump. I'm a trans man of color, and I was crying on the phone as I put my mail-in ballots into the mail. I was on the phone with my mother trying to explain to her that if he's elected, there will be active attacks on my very existence. I would like to have health care. I would like to use the bathroom. I would like to not be discriminated against just because I identify as a man and not a woman. Right. We didn't speak for 2 years after that. And what happens, and I love my mother with all my heart still to this day. Absolutely do. I still don't understand that vote. But, you know, what causes it to happen? I'm not quite certain. But with respect to this, you know, and on CPAC last night, there was some Republican that called for the eradication. That's a quote, eradication of transgender people. That is a synonym for genocide. Eradication, I suppose that they could try to backpedal and say, well, we just mean stop being transgender. But what else do you mean about the quality of life and the suicides that will flow from that, the other acts of self-harm that will likely flow from that? I think that to answer your question further, I think that when you lack real merit and real substance to stand on, you need a distraction. You need smoke and mirrors. You need a scapegoat, right? And I don't think I'm going too far to say, I'm not going to go that far, but I am going to say that when you call for the eradication of a people, that's genocide.
Yeah.
And that's how it gets started, too. If you look back at your history books, of course, when the leaders of the day are allowed to stand front and center and call for eradication of a people, that's how you end up with 6 million people dead.
That's right. That is absolutely right. And we have seen that before in history. And you don't have to look too far back to see some examples of that.
And in fact, just a little point, I want to say it was in 1858. I'll have to look. But the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that African Americans were not citizens, right? So we don't have to go far, 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 far back, right? We don't have to go to various world wars, or we can go farther than that, I should say. But eradication, not citizens, all of this and parcel of, as you properly called it, gross conduct, right? It's just a gross miscarriage of justice. It's hard to even put the word justice into the same sentence with it. But that's what we're facing right now.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we live in California, obviously, and it feels I don't know if it feels safe for everybody. I can't say that, but we're in a bubble. We're at least in a legal bubble. So what should we be doing in California in response to states like Tennessee?
I think that in the same way that we handled the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, attorney Joaquin McCoy, he argued for marriage equality and was a large part of why we have marriage equality in California. I think that we're going to see a lot of amicus curiae, friends of the court briefs. And again, obviously, as a lawyer, I'm speaking from what's within my power to assist with. But I think that also we call on our allies throughout the nation, which, you know, myself and other transgender people have begun doing. Olivia Hill is really at the forefront of that in Tennessee. And quite frankly, it's been everything inside of me to hold myself here in California and not go to Tennessee, because I really am having to keep focused on what I have on my plate right in front of me. And I think a lot of us feel the same way. So reaching out to them, fundraising for the leaders who are similarly situated and like-minded and that are at the forefront of this fight. And it really is important throughout the nation to stand up, because when injustice knocks at the door of your neighbor, your door is not far behind.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. For our young transgender listeners, our young gender nonconforming, gender non-binary folks, for our young people who just aren't sure yet who they are, and they're seeing all of this take place, what's your advice for them?
Rise above the noise. I wish that I had known to trust myself so much longer ago. When I was younger, and I had the right answers. It's hard to not have the right answers when your opinion is on yourself. You're the subject matter expert. Mm-hmm. No one has been you or is you. So there is no higher authority to tell you who you are than you. So slow down, take your time, and listen to that voice inside for your counsel.
Love that. Rise above the noise and trust yourself. Those are two valuable points.
Yeah. Well, and it does get better. I got to say this one. It really does get better. I was on food stamps for at one point of my life after I transitioned after 40. I was on CalFresh. Life doesn't stop because you transition. In fact, it sometimes gets even more active. But if you will persevere, if you will believe in yourself, if you will listen to that voice inside, that's your true north, and you will be okay. And you'll be better than okay. And now I run a multi-million-dollar law firm, and no one could have told me that that would be the case. And I am a proud trans man of color. So don't give up.
I love that. So where can people go to learn about Huff Law and follow you?
At GitHuff number one, the number one, GitHuff one on Instagram is a good place. Attorney Huff, Michael Huff on LinkedIn. A great start is www.hufflegal.com. And from there, you ought to be able to find all that you need. Certainly, you can get in contact with me, and I'm GitHuff, Attorney Huff on Facebook. So any of those is a good way to reach me. 833-GET-HUFF is the phone number. That's 833-438-4833. 833-GET-HUFF.
Perfect. And if you missed that website, I'll put it on our own website at outbeatnews.com. You can just click show notes at the top of the page and find links to get in touch with Huff Law. Wow. Thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight. Your story is absolutely fascinating, but you know, you're a great role model for a lot of young people. And I appreciate that a lot.
I appreciate you saying that. And thanks for having me, Professor.
And that wraps up our hour. Be sure to tune in next Sunday night for an Outbeat Extra with Gary Carnevale. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com.
I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do. So I give it up to you.
You're broken down and tired of living life on the merry-go-round, and you can't find a fighter, but I see it in you, so we're gonna walk it out. Move mountains. We're gonna walk it out and move mountains. And I'll rise like the day. I'll rise unafraid. I'll rise up, and I do it a thousand times again. And I'll rise up, I like the waves. I'll rise up in spite of the ache. I'll rise up, and I do it a thousand silence is a quiet, and it feels like it's getting hard to breathe. And I know you feel like dying, but I promise we'll take the world to its feet. Move mountains, bring it to its feet. Move mountains. And I'll rise up, I'll rise like the day. I'll rise up, I'll rise unafraid. I'll rise up, and I'll do it a thousand times again. For you, for you, for you.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County, with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roner Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Beale Street Caravan is next.